Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Now, we often think to become a success in today's modern world, you have to specialize and specialize early. My guest today makes the case that actually, the most creative, innovative, and successful people don't specialize, they're generalists. His name is David Epstein, and he's the author of the book Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. We begin our conversation discussing two different paths to success as embodied by Tiger Woods and Roger Federer, and why we're naturally drawn to the former specialized approach, even though the latter's generalized approach is in fact the most common way to success. David then explains why our increasingly complex and abstract world requires not only having a depth, but a breadth of knowledge, and how our education system hinders us from gaining such. David and I discuss why you shouldn't expect to know exactly what you're going to do for your career when you're young, why you should dabble in lots of different activities when you're first starting out in life, why you should keep doing that even when you're older, and why there's a correlation between having hobbies and winning the Nobel Prize. We also dig into why intrinsic motivation is often mistaken for grit, why you shouldn't be afraid to sometimes quit things, and the importance of finding pursuits that fit you if you want to achieve success. We end our conversation with David's argument that our increasing specialization is not only stifling individual flourishing, but also getting in the way of scientific advances that would benefit society. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/range. David joins me now via clearcast.io. All right, David Epstein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me again. Only 6 years after my agent told me not to let it be 5 years before I have another book out.
Right. Well, your last book that we had you on to talk about was The Sports Gene,
right?
Which discusses, you know, why some people are just great at certain sports. But you got a new book out, kind of a left. You said it's a left turn, but I think there's a connection. It's called Range: Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. Did The Sports Gene sort of begin the thinking about this book?
It absolutely did. And in fact, it sort of led to this book, even though this book departs from sports after the introduction. It really grew out of The Sports Gene in the sense that after The Sports Gene came out, I was invited to the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference to have a debate with Malcolm Gladwell. So it's like on YouTube titled The Sports Gene versus 10,000 Hours, even though we actually have significant middle ground. And, you know, because he's very clever and I didn't want to get embarrassed and I'd never met him before, I guessed that he would argue about the importance of a head start in athletic development in very narrow, technical, so-called deliberate practice. So I went and gathered up, you know, all the studies I could find that tracked the development of future elite athletes. And what I saw was a pattern where, in fact, rather than doing sort of the Tiger Woods, where they specialize very early, they have what scientists call a sampling period early, where they gain a breadth of general skills, try an array of sports, learn about their own abilities and their own interests, and systematically delay specialization until later than their peers who plateau at lower levels. So I brought that to the debate saying, this is your hypothesis, and here's the data that cannot fit with that hypothesis. And afterward, we became running buddies and sort of would talk about it on our own time. And I filed it away in the back of my brain until this point I describe in Range, where I got involved with the Pat Tillman Foundation that basically helps military veterans career change, and gave a little talk about this. And they were so hungry for information about how to bring diverse experiences to bear on whatever they were going to do, because they felt like they were behind when in fact they actually had all these powerful experiences and skills that their peers didn't. And so I started to think I should really investigate this far outside the sports world and see if we see this same pattern of an advantage accruing to people who go broad early and maintain breadth even as everyone around them is rushing to specialize.
Okay, let's talk about how you started off with the sports stick, right? The sports analogy.
Yeah.
You mentioned there's two approaches to how we go about, or people have about going, you know, becoming an expert. And the one you said, there's the Tiger Woods method. And then you also say in the book, there's the Roger Federer way. So talk about, Tiger Woods and Roger Federer, can you do like compare and contrast between those two approaches?
Yeah, sure. So originally I titled the book proposal Roger versus Tiger. So Tiger Woods, I think his development story is pretty well known. He was physically precocious. He could like balance on his father's palm at 6 months old. There are pictures of this in his father's book. He was, by the time he was two, he was on television golfing. And by the time he was three, his father was already giving him like media training for his future. And by the time he was four, he was like hustling adults at golf courses. You know, and by the time he was a teenager, he was famous and went on to become the best golfer in the world. And so that this very early specialization, this kind of 10,000 hours rule centric specialization became the analogy for a huge number of books that write about performance and how to get good at stuff, saying just extrapolate this to whatever it is that you want to do. Meanwhile, Roger Federer, his story is much less well known. He played a huge array of sports as a kid. His mother was actually a tennis coach and refused to coach him because he wouldn't like return balls in a normal way and do sort of structured practice. When he actually got good enough to get bumped up a level, he declined because he just wanted to talk about WWE with his friends after practice. And actually, when he first got good enough to get interviewed by a local paper and the reporter asked him what he would buy with his first paycheck if he ever became a pro, he said a Mercedes, and his mother was totally appalled and asked the reporter if she could listen to a recording of the interview, and he obliged. And what Roger had actually said was Mercedes in a Swiss German accent. He just wanted more CDs. So unlike Tiger, he didn't have these big dreams of being a tennis pro. He didn't specialize. His mother forced him to continue playing badminton, basketball, and soccer long after some of his peers were not only specialized in tennis, but working with sports psychologists and nutritionists. And of course, Rogers rose to the pinnacle of his domain as well. And so my question was, which model, the Roger model or the Tiger model, is the more common one en route to expertise?
So, I mean, it's kind of interesting because you mentioned, you know, ever since Tiger Woods, there's been all these books put out about how his approach is the way. If you want to become an expert in your domain, you got to do the Tiger approach. But I feel like this has existed even before Tiger, that we had this idea that if you want to become the very best, you had to get started young. I mean, people use examples of like Mozart, right? Who started, you know, composing music when he was three or four. And said, well, if you want your kid to be great and whatever, you got to get him started young. Why do you think that makes sense? And why do we think that the Federer approach, where you sort of dabble and sort of, you know, act like a dilettante, is looked down upon?
And the Federer approach, by the way, turns out to be the normal one for athletes who go on to succeed. And I think it's multifaceted. First of all, it's not that intuitive, right? We are absolutely not programmed to think that there could be anything wrong with a head start, or that there is, if you want to be good in X, that you should do anything other than X in order to become the best at that. It's not intuitive. I also think it's partly a holdover from the pre-knowledge economy era, where the structure of most every organization that people were involved with was very upper out, right? It was the tasks that people had to do for work were much more standardized, and they could do similar things over and over and over again. And so they were used to being narrow and quite specialized. And then I think these things like Tiger and this whole genre of books that picked on Tiger and Mozart, essentially, and also some chess players, sort of stoked our obsession with precocity, right? And what those books do is they use these prodigies to say, this, anybody can do this in any domain. But the reality of it is that they pick very particular domains that people who study skill acquisition know are horrible models of almost everything else people want to learn. So it's like this magic trick where they say, look at this classical music prodigy, look at this golf prodigy, do this in whatever you're interested in. But that's where the sleight of hand happens, because if you look into the research of how people get good at things, golf is like a uniquely poor model of almost everything else that people want to get good at.
Well, so yeah, so it's not to say the Tiger Woods approach does not work. It only works in specific domains. So like golf would be one. I think you mentioned chess is one.
Yeah.
Music, possibly. And I guess what all these have in common is that they're very procedural. Like once you learn the steps, you just keep doing the steps over and over again, you can get better at it.
I mean, people who study skill acquisition basically classify golf as like an industrial task, where you're not really dealing with much human behavior. You're not dealing with teammates. It's non-dynamic. Essentially, you're trying to do the known movements, like you know the answer, and you're trying to execute it over and over with as little deviation as possible. And that is the epitome of what psychologists call a kind learning environment, basically. And as is chess to a less degree, but still very much so, as are certain aspects of classical music, but not music overall. And so it's very telling that basically child prodigies always come in a very small range of domains that psychologists who study skill acquisition classify like more like kind of industrial domains and things that are easy to automate, essentially. So it's a very small, it's the minority of domains, but a half dozen bestsellers at least that I can just think of off the top of my head, use them to extrapolate to everything else. And that's where these inappropriate conclusions are made. Because in fact, the Tiger model may well work for golf. There's actually like a surprising dearth of research on golf compared to other sports. So I don't know, the jury's out, but because of the structure of the domain, I can definitely believe that early specialization is the way to go in golf. But in sports where there are other people involved, where the situations are much more dynamic, where you have to react to things quickly, it is absolutely not the way to go. You want to think of it more like studying language. So we know people who grew up multilingual are better able to learn a third language, even a made-up one, if scientists give it to them in experiment, without being told the rules. And that looks the same for people who play multiple sports that involve anticipation of what other people are doing or of flying objects. So if you do a bunch of different things early, you're better equipped to be able to pick up any new skills going forward. And so that's what you really want, that general framework that allows you to become a master learner, basically.
Okay, so procedural skills, those are a kind learning environment because you can just learn the things, then you can master them. I guess the other domains that aren't like that, where they're complex, dynamic, you call these wicked worlds, or what learning psychologists, skill acquisition psychologists call a wicked world.
Yeah, and so to define a kind learning environment, so it's basically a task where patterns repeat over and over. The task itself is very constrained by very clear rules. And every time you do something, you get feedback that is both immediate and fully accurate. So we can think of, if you think of something like chess, it's very constrained. People aren't allowed to move at the same time, right? You have to pause before another person does something. There's an enormous database of previous games. Patterns repeat over and over. In fact, grandmasters rely on pattern study to do what they do. And the feedback for a move comes quick and all the information is available. And this happens to be what makes it so easy to automate, which is why computers, one of the first things they mastered was chess, because it's a kind learning environment. On the other end of the spectrum are most of the things that humans want to learn, where not all the information is available. You're dealing with real-time human behavior and lots of things moving at once. Not all the information, there's information that's hidden from you. You may get feedback, but you might not get it all the time. It may be delayed. It may be partial. It may be inaccurate. So Robin Hogarth, the psychologist who coined this kind, wicked learning environment, used as an example a famous physician who was renowned for being able to diagnose typhoid like weeks before a patient had any symptoms at all. And he would do that by palpating their tongue or feeling around their tongue with his hands. And over, he could predict who was going to get typhoid before they had a single symptom. And one of his colleagues later pointed out that he was a more prolific carrier of typhoid than Typhoid Mary, because he was the one giving typhoid to these patients by feeling around their tongues. And so in that case, the positive feedback reinforced the exact wrong lesson. So that's like a super wicked, like most of the things we're doing are not quite that wicked, but they're more toward the wicked end of the spectrum. Like tennis is further from the kind end of the spectrum than golf, but sports are still, far, far from the wicked end of the spectrum compared to most of the things that people are trying to do in the world of work.
Yeah, business is a wicked world because there's so many constituent parts and they interact with each other in complex ways that you can't predict. Politics would be one, just management, like working in organizations. There's all these different people with different interests and you don't know what their interests are. And so you can't develop a system to manage that.
That's a great point, this shows up. So in more wicked learning environments, what you want is breadth. So there's a classic finding, again, in people who study how we acquire skills that goes like this. Breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. So what you want to do in a world where you're not repeating the same thing over and over, the trick is to be able to apply your knowledge and skills to situations you've never seen before. So not like golf, not like chess. And if you want to be able to do that, you want to have really broad training, because instead of learning procedures, what you're trying to do is learn these general abstractions that are frameworks that you can apply going forward. So, to use some research that I cite in Range is training people to respond to, training on simulations to respond to naval threats, essentially. Training commanders. And they tested all these different methods of training. And some of the people would practice a certain scenario over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until they got really good over the course of that day on responding to a certain scenario. Other people saw a different scenario every time in training. And at the end of the training period, the people who were always seeing a different scenario were frustrated. They felt like they hadn't learned much because they weren't performing that well. Whereas the people who saw similar scenarios over and over and sort of internalized those procedures got better and better. And then when they bring them back and show them situations they've never seen before, the people who were frustrated in training and had this broad training destroy the people who were doing this, who were sort of mastering specific scenarios over and over. And these are, again, on situations that none of them have ever seen before. And so the breadth of their training predicted how well they could transfer their skills to totally new situations. And that's sort of the theme in the more wicked end of the learning environment. So I was just reading some LinkedIn research you mentioned in business that looked at 500,000 members and what was the best predictor of someone going on to become an executive. And it was the number of different job functions they had worked across in their domain. Actually, if they'd gone to a top five MBA program was almost as about as influential, but that they couldn't tell if that was because of the school or just because of the student selection or whatever. But in terms of things that were more in people's control, the number of different job functions they had worked across. And I think that's a similar finding, right? It's their breadth of training gives them the ability to manage situations they've never seen before.
Well, I'd like to talk about some research you highlight in the book that I thought was really interesting that highlights the need of more breadth in your thinking and your skill acquisition. And you talk about the Flynn effect, right? And this is the idea that over the past few decades, IQ scores have been going up every year. But they're just trying to figure out, like, why is that happening? So why is it that we've been getting better at IQ tests? Like, are we getting smarter, or is it just the way that we think is changing that make us do better IQ tests?
Yeah, it was over most of the course of the 20th century, a rise of about 3 points per decade. And that's so much that, like, our great-grandparents would look handicapped compared to us if the tests weren't re-standardized. The tests are always re-standardized, so 100 is the average. And we're not, like, we don't have better brains than them, right? So the question for psychologists who saw this pattern is, well, why are people getting more questions right? And not only getting more questions right, but getting more questions right in the places where the test was least supposed to change over time. So the most abstract questions. So that the IQ test that showed the biggest change over time was one called Raven's Progressive Matrices, where you just get this. This was designed to be what's called a culturally reduced test. So, like, nothing you learn in life or school should affect your performance. So if Martians landed on Earth, this is the test you'd give them, and it could show how clever they were because it doesn't involve any learning. And it just involves these abstract patterns and ones missing. And you just have to look at the ones that are there and try to fill in the missing one. And scores rose extremely rapidly on that test where the least change was expected. And it turns out that that's the case. Even if you look at the more concrete tests, we aren't doing that much better on specific subjects, you know, vocabulary and that stuff. But wherever there are more abstract questions, people are doing much, much better. Even in cases where test scores in some countries have gone backward on specific learning in things like math and vocabulary, they've still improved on these more abstract questions. And the evidence suggests that that's because as we moved from a world where we were less focused on the concrete in front of us and focused on our experience, where we moved to a world where work is much more interconnected, it's much more based on knowledge that you have to transfer. Like, we get by transferring our skills to different situations all the time and to different jobs. And we take that for granted now. But that's not something that people 100 years ago were as capable of. The world didn't demand it of them as much. They could be much more comfortable sort of staying in a very narrow lane of knowledge and repeating known tasks and procedures. But as the world has become more complex, we have adapted to that by becoming better at abstract thinking, which means it's not that one type of thinking is better than the other per se, but we're much more adapted to an environment where we can laterally transfer our knowledge to totally new tasks very effectively.
Well, can you give us an example of, like, say, an abstract question? If you ask, say, you know, someone in 1875, they would have, like, a hard time, you know, answering it because they would be thinking in concrete terms.
Yeah. So there are, for example, in Range, I write about this through a Russian psychologist who when the Soviet Union is undergoing, you know, socialist revolution, and they are nationalizing this remote farmland in what today is Uzbekistan. And these people who have been subsistence farmers and had to be very, very good at the things they know, but didn't have to know much else, are suddenly being connected to the rest of the world. And some of them are, so they're having to manage work with other people, not just with themselves. And when you ask them things, first of all, if you ask them to classify things like objects or colors, they basically are unwilling to do that. Whereas some of the people who have had some exposure to modernity, they can classify, like if you give them shapes, they'll always liken it to an object, right? So if it's a circle, then it's a coin. And if it's a dotted circle, then it's a watch. Whereas the people who have been exposed to some modernity can classify all the different types of circles together in a group. Even if they don't know the word circle, they'll recognize that there's some abstract commonality. And that sort of thing shows up all the way up to sort of formal logic, where if you ask some of these more pre-modern people, for example, you know, who are not working in the world of connected work, things like they'll say, well, cotton grows well where it's hot and dry. In England, it's cold and wet. Does cotton grow well in England? They'll basically refuse to answer and say things like, well, you'd have to ask someone who's been there. In the case where those questions were asked of people who were experts in cotton growing, if you really push them, they might say like, well, it probably shouldn't grow there if it's cold and wet. So you can kind of push them. But if you use a question that uses the exact same logical structures, but something they're unfamiliar with, they can't answer it. So one of the questions that Luria asked was this logic problem where he says something like, where it's cold and there's snow, all the bears are white. And then he says, like, in Novaya Zemlya, this town in the far north, there is always snow. What color are the bears there? And they can't answer it. They'll say, like, I don't know, I haven't been there. Or you'd have to talk to someone who's been there. And so they're unable to transfer knowledge to situations they've never seen before, which again doesn't mean that their thinking is worse per se, but it is not well adapted to the kind of transfer between domains that we're very well equipped to do today.
Okay, so most of the thinking we do in the modern world, if you live in a Western modern world, is abstraction, right? Like, yeah. A lot of our work is just abstract. Even, you know, the way you interact with the world, like a video game, is an abstraction, right? You understand totally. It's not actually you're playing Red Dead Redemption. You're not actually riding a real horse. It is a, you know, pixels of a horse. So that helps us think like that. So despite this more abstract world, how do we school? Are we educating kids and young people to do well in this abstract world? Or do we kind of go back to that very like concrete, like you need to learn these vocab words and you need to know this information, et cetera?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And to pick up on what you mentioned about Red Dead Redemption, not to go backward, but just for a sec, we are so accustomed to abstraction, so good at it, we totally take it for granted, right? Like when you are, whatever, like downloading the latest Flash update or whatever it is on your computer and you see some bar that's like filling up a progress bar to 100%, that's a massive series of abstractions. That bar is some sort of representation of time, which itself is some representation of this huge number of underlying instructions that the computer is carrying out, which itself is an abstraction that's actually just a bunch of zeros and ones that the computer is using, right? And so there's all these layers of abstraction. So computer programmers do really well on cognitive tests of abstraction because they have to come up with stuff like this. And so I think in the sense, in one way, I think we're doing a good job preparing people for this world in the sense that if you think about video games and you think about the way we deal with apps and computers now, we've gotten really used to doing things without instructions and trying to deduce the rules and just start learning something by using it, right? This is what Robin Hogarth, the kind, wicked psychologist, he says, never mind golf and tennis. Most of us in the world are playing Martian tennis where there's something going on, but you don't know the rules. Nobody's told you and they're subject to change without notice and you just have to deduce them and they could change at any time. So you may have to deduce them again. So I think the world at large is doing a decent job, but school-wise, not great. I think if you look at, people always complain about the school system today compared to yesteryear. And if you look at tests of basic skills, without question, students now do way better than our parents did. No question. The problem is the challenge has gotten much more difficult because our economy is so based on transferable knowledge. the improvements aren't keeping pace with what's really sort of needed in the world, basically. Like if you look at tests that were given a generation ago to sixth graders, it's very procedural, very procedural. Like, and if you look at them now, it requires a lot more abstract thinking. And so I think there's some movement in that direction, but it's not fast enough. And what James Flynn, the discoverer of the Flynn effect, describes in Range is this problem where teachers and professors tend to lean toward didactic information, filling people with information or with procedures on how to do things, because it's easy to conceptualize that. It's easy to teach, and you see immediate progress. The problem is it doesn't build these more fundamental general skills that allow you to then better learn anything later on. And so he was sort of, he describes in the book this study he did looking at how well grades in college at an elite college corresponded to the ability of a student to do well on like a really important abstract thinking test that that tests the kind of critical thinking that you need in the world. And the correlation was zero between grades in college and the scores on that test, which suggests that there's a real disconnect. And if you look at some of the data he's collected, it suggests that the work world is doing a decent, is having a larger input into making people better abstract thinkers than school is. So I think we're missing an opportunity there.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining. On the pants, you can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor Meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. It's a good deal. That's code manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn.
Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
Well, and we can keep talking about school because you have a chapter about approaches teachers take to teaching students. And one way that, you know, when you sit in on a class and you listen to a teacher interact with a student, you see this interaction take place where the teacher is, you know, asking questions, but also giving hints and help, trying to help the student like feel some success early on so they don't get discouraged. But what's the study? What does the research say on that, that sort of teaching method?
Yeah. So similar to some of the sports research, what it says and what you're describing is this scene from this international math study that opens chapter four, where this really charismatic teacher is, you know, teaching math to young students. And what happens over and over is the students sort of learn to play a form of multiple choice where she'll pose a problem to them that might require some abstract thinking or some conceptual thinking, or it might not. But either way, the way that they interact with the teacher will cause her to give so many hints that they can always turn what's called a making connections problem, where you're forced to connect different ideas, into a using procedures problem, where they just figure out rules that they can apply over and over. And when you do using procedures practice, which you need some of for sure, but the good thing about using procedures practice is you see progress right away. The bad thing is it undermines future progress because you're not learning how to connect ideas in a much larger system. And so the countries that do better in math education, like Japan, instead of having practice over and over and over again to practice procedures on problems, you go into a classroom there, and I've been there and seen this, and the whole class period might be one problem where there's a huge blackboard that's the size of an entire wall. All the kids have name magnets. The teacher will do one problem that can connect a large number of different concepts. At each stage, he asks students for ideas. They come up, write their idea down. They stick their magnet next to it. It may be right or wrong. And then other students try different ideas. And at the end of the class, you have this like captain's log of the intellectual journey of the class as they connected a bunch of different ideas and went through false starts and one problem. And so Japan actually has a word that means this kind of writing on a blackboard that connects ideas and tracks the thinking through the class. It's called bansho. And Japan does much better using these making connections kinds of questions, whereas the US is much more focused on using procedures. And that's just like golf. Using procedures is fine as long as you're going to face the exact same problems over and over again. But what you really want is not to teach the students how to use procedures, but to teach them how to pick the right strategy for a type of problem. And that's a totally different thing. And this actually relates, I don't want to go on too long on this, but this relates to what I thought was kind of the single most surprising study in the book for me, if you want me to share that one.
Go ahead.
So the single most surprising study to me was this one in chapter four done at the U.S. Air Force Academy, because I don't think you could set up this. There would be no other way to set up this study. And what happened was these researchers wanted to look at the impact of teaching on student achievement over time, not just in a single class. And the Air Force has this incredible setup for this experiment because it brings in students every year. They all have to take a certain sequence of math courses, and they are randomized to their professor in the first class. And they all have to take the exact same test, and it's graded the exact same way. And it's basically the whole grade for the course. And then they are re-randomized the next year to the follow-on course, Calculus 2 or whatever it is. And then they are re-randomized again the next year. So you get these multiple steps of randomization and the students' abilities coming in are spread evenly across these classes, you can really see the effect of professors. And what the researchers found was that the teachers who were the best at promoting good test scores in their own class systematically undermined the future performance of their students in future classes. So those teachers would teach more narrowly because they knew what the students had to learn to do well on the test. The students would rate those teachers really well because they could see instant progress. They would do well on the test. And then they would underperform in all their future classes. Whereas the teachers whose students rated lower because they were more difficult, they taught much more broad concepts, connected ideas. Those students often struggled on the Calculus 1 exam and then overperformed in all the subsequent courses, which is really counterintuitive. And we're not programmed to think that we could be making progress before our eyes and that could be undermining our long-term development. But again, it's the same thing you see in the sports literature and the math learning literature and in a whole bunch of other domains that I talk about in Range.
Well, it's like that Navy study, right? The group that learned the procedure on that, how to handle a certain situation, a certain war game, they did well initially, but when they got put into something different, they got tanked.
Exactly. So if you want somebody, if your goal is for the individual to be able to respond well to situations that aren't exactly like something that's come before, what you want to do is force them into an environment where they have to learn to connect ideas and build these abstractions that they can fit to new situations, as opposed to giving them procedures that they know how to execute as long as they're seeing exactly something they've seen before.
And I imagine there's like, kids are really good at finding procedures. So if you're a parent with a kid in school and you notice that, man, they're doing really well all the time, well, it might be because they just figured out a procedure. Like they have a knack for finding the procedure and they're just following that procedure and it might not benefit them in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that cognitive psychologist Nate Cornell says in that chapter is that difficulty is not a sign that you aren't learning, but ease is a sign that you aren't learning. So if something is too easy for you, then you're not really learning. It's when progress is made too fast, that should actually be kind of a warning sign. The problem is we've set up our evaluation systems, you know, and we're just oriented. It's more intuitive just to be oriented toward before your eyes progress. Like, you know, what could be bad about that? What could ever be bad about a head start? But it turns out that whether it's in math or sports, the way to develop the best 10-year-old is not the same as the way to develop the best 20-year-old.
Okay, so if we want to excel in this world of abstraction where you're going to be faced with problems you've never encountered before, we want to get a broad range of skills, a broad range of things so we can make connections. Let's talk about some ways we can do that. You gave this great example. I never heard of this group. It's the Vigile de Coro. Did I say that right?
This is a tough one. It's technically pronounced Filia del Coro.
Filia de Coro. This
it's,
was like
it's spelled Figli del Coro, Figli, but it's pronounced Filia. It's Italian.
So this was a group of musicians at a convent, right, in France, like in the 1700s, where they became world renowned and famous. And it was kind of counterintuitive how they got to that point.
Yeah. So in Italy, they were in Venice, and they were in the 17th and 18th centuries, and not just musicians, but the filia, which means, that just means daughters. Filia del Coro means daughters of the choir, technically. And they were actually, basically, so Venice had a very vibrant sex industry at the time. And that led to a problem, which was babies, especially baby girls who didn't have fathers, would end up in the canals sometimes. And this was recognized as a social ill that needed to be fixed. And these institutions were established. They weren't technically convents. They weren't technically religious, but they sort of had quasi-monastic rules that they ran by. And they were attached to churches. And basically they had like the most famous one called, they were called hospitals, but they weren't really hospitals. Because the Ospedale del Pietà, the House of Mercy, basically. It had like a luggage check thing. You know, when you go to an airline and if you can fit your carry-on in that check thing, then you can bring it on. They had one in the door where if you put the baby and the baby fit in there, you can ring a little bell and they'll come pick it up and they'll raise it, no questions asked, if it fits in the carry-on luggage thing. And that they called the scafetta. And they would try to raise these girls to become self-sufficient. And the ospedale was its own like internal economy and all these things. And at a certain point, people started, they would pay the girls as they wanted to make them self-sufficient for learning different skills. So they'd give them a little money reward. And at a certain point, people started donating used instruments there. And the girls would realize, hey, you know, they can, one, it's fun. And also it counts as new skills if they learn a different instrument. So they would start trying to learn a whole bunch of different instruments. Some of these instruments, musicologists no longer even know what they were because they were these like experimental instruments. And by in the course of learning this large number of instruments, the people who ran the ospedali started to notice that they could pick up anything really, really quickly. They had built these sort of models of how to learn music. And so they started having them perform in the adjoining churches. And they were so good that money started pouring into the ospedali. And so they started having more performances. Antonio Vivaldi, who the composer of the Four Seasons, which is probably like now the most famous, arguably like the most famous, it's like almost a pop hit and it's 300 years old, basically, right? There's like a mashup with the song from Disney's Frozen that has 100 million views on YouTube or something. And they became Vivaldi's muses. He recognized their ability to pick up anything, to pick up new forms of music, and they became his muses, and he sort of became their composer, and they became the greatest musicians in the world. These orphans of the Venetian sex industry, whose training consisted of attempting to learn as many different instruments as they possibly could, which equipped them with this ability to learn entirely new types of music and new instruments, like on a whim. And for 100 years, until Napoleon came and his troops took over Venice, they were the greatest musicians in the world.
Yeah, I mean, one of them, I think you have an example like this. One, she got too old to play a particular instrument, so she like just, okay, I got to play this instrument now. And she was able to do it really easy. Like the transition was smooth.
Yeah, well, her teeth fell out, so she couldn't play the wind instrument she'd played anymore. So she just switched to one of the other ones and kept performing.
So these are people who didn't get like that head start training where they're, you know, the mom and dad was having them sit down and do, you know, scales, you know, from morning till night. They were just messing around with these instruments. And then you also like jazz musicians were the same way. Some of the greatest jazz composers, most of them didn't get any formal training. They just kind of picked up a guitar and then figured out how to play it. And they came up with this really complex new ways of playing music.
Yeah, two different jazz people that I interview in the chapter on music, two jazz players and instructors told me the same joke one time when I was interviewing them. And it goes like this. You if you're a jazz musician, you know, you ask one of the guys you're about to play with if they can read music, and they're supposed to respond, "Not enough to hurt my playing." And a lot of them do, in fact, learn how to play music, but they learn they do what I call learning like a baby. So when you learn language, you don't learn the grammar first, right? You learn the sound, you get thrown in, you're immersed, you struggle, you fail, and then you learn the grammar much later, if at all. And that seems to be the way, so that the sort of 10,000 hour school has focused very narrowly on a certain type of classical playing. So I mentioned in Range, the Cambridge Handbook of Expertise, which is like the Bible of the 10,000 hour rule school, has an entire chapter on music, and it's all on a very particular type of classical music. And then there's just like one offhanded mention where it's like, in jazz and modern popular music, it seems like actually the people are much broader and start later and sample more stuff. And then it just goes back to, so it basically just gives that short shrift, most of the types of music that everyone listens to and plays now. And those musicians develop much more along the Roger model than the Tiger model, where they sample different instruments. Their practice doesn't explode until they find an instrument that fits them. So if you look at this research over time, it's not that the musicians who end up practicing a lot, who are exceptional, generally are just practice-aholics. It's they go through more instruments than their peers. So some of their peers will stick with their first instrument, even if it's not a great fit. They feel like they have a head start and can't switch. Whereas the students who go on to become exceptional, they sample instruments until they find one that they think is a fit, and then their practice volume explodes. So it looks more like, less like they personally are just practice fanatics, and more like they're maximizing what economists call their match quality, the degree of fit between who they are, their abilities and interests, and what they do. And that seems to be the rule for most of music development, with some exceptions.
Well, let's talk about that idea of fit, because people have this idea that, you know, particularly if you're a young person, you're in college, you're 20 years old, you got to pick a major, you have to know whether you're going to go to medical school or law school, even if you don't even know like if you like medicine or law, and then you just have to grind it out until you get there. And you might find out, man, I just don't like doing this. Like, why do we overlook that idea of fit? Like, you know, finding something that we're actually good at.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because Theodore Schultz, a Nobel laureate economist, sort of chastised his field for overlooking fit. Like, we had studied higher education and saw that, okay, it makes people more productive by giving them some skills. But he said, we've overlooked studying the effect on match quality, which is that because people come out of high school, they know very little about the world. They know relatively little about themselves. It's all, you know, everything they know is constrained by their roster of previous experiences. And what about when they get to have a sampling period like the athletes? Does that influence how good they become and how well they fit with what they're doing? And the answer is it absolutely does. So in Range, I discuss research on an economist who found sort of a natural experiment by looking at school systems where people are made to specialize at different times, you know, some in their teen years and then some can delay until later. And what he finds is that the people who specialize earlier jump out to an income lead, but by about 6 years into their work, the later specializers catch and surpass them. And the earlier specializers start quitting their careers in much higher numbers because they didn't have enough time to sample and figure out a good fit in the first place or to optimize their match quality. And so there's, of course, nothing wrong with getting a law degree or getting a medical degree, but I think the research suggests it's actually a dangerous thing to decide to do before you really know if that's a good long-term goal for yourself. So you need a little sampling to maximize your match quality. And all the research in this area suggests that when people change careers and jobs, they're set back a little bit in certain specific skills, but their growth rate becomes much higher because each time they do it, they are responding to match quality information and optimizing their fit with what it is that they're doing.
Well, going back to like the sports gene, this made me think of like, you know, why some athletes do well in certain sports is because their body is fit for that sport. Like Michael Phelps, you know, he works hard, right? But like his body's designed for swimming. But if he decided I want to play whatever sport and just like grind it out, he might've been okay, but he probably wouldn't have been reached the level as he did in swimming.
Right. I mean, he obviously has these traits like, you know, willingness to practice and all these things. But again, that usually follows match quality, not preceding it. So there's no evidence that he would have been a fanatical trainer if he were a runner, for example. And that's a lot of research I discussed that suggests that once someone finds a fit, it just looks like they're a fanatical trainer or like that's their personality. But like, if you look at the guy who's the world record holder in the mile, who's 7 inches shorter than Phelps, they wear the same length pants because their bodies are conducive to different types of performance. And I think one of the many reasons why we see that Roger pattern in the development of sports is that as we push selection earlier and earlier, people aren't even biologically mature yet. And the earlier you push selection, the more in anything, the more likely you put the wrong person in the wrong thing. And that's also why in sports, we see this so-called relative age effect, where unlike junior national teams, you see this incredible concentration of kids who are just born early in whatever the selection year is because they're more biologically mature than their peers and their coaches mistake that for their potential. And then that effect disappears at the elite level. So, which suggests to me that it's a really bad system and causes us to deselect a lot of people who would potentially go on to become elite.
Right. And so this dabbling period, it allows you to find what you're good at. And you said like, you know, these guys who in sports, they dabble, they eventually find their fit. Like Michael Phelps finally finds swimming, Roger Federer finally finds tennis. But this can also apply, you know, to just like personality or your brain. Like, I mean, I think they've done studies like the human brain isn't fully formed until like 25, 26. So you might be almost a completely different person when you're 26 than when you were at 18, when you were deciding your life trajectory.
In fact, you're getting at an important concept in Range called the end of history illusion. So this is the psychological finding that when we all look backward, we say, oh gosh, we really changed a lot because of all our experiences in the past, but we think that we're mostly done or we won't change that much in the future. And it turns out that we're wrong at every stage of development. So personality, the time of most rapid personality change is from about 18 through your late 20s. And so if you're picking what you're doing at age 16 or 17 or 18, you're absolutely selecting a career for someone that you don't even know yet. That the correlation between someone's teen years and middle age for a particular personality trait for the statistically inclined is usually like 0.2 or 0.3, which means there is absolutely still signs of the previous you in the later you that are distinguishable, but you are a very different person. That's like a low moderate kind of correlation. So we all change more than we expect, which leads to some really funny results, by the way. Like when people think their preferences will stay the same. So when they're asked how much they would pay to see their favorite band today in 10 years from now, $129 is the average answer. But asked how much they would pay to see their favorite band from 10 years ago today, the average is only $80. Because we underestimate how much our preferences will change. And the way that I discuss this in range is that because we underestimate personality change, we really need to be ready to adjust a lot going forward, because we're facing the challenge of how to behave when we don't know the future us or the future world that we'll be living in, and what's the best approach to take when you're facing that problem.
So basically, if you are 22 years old listening to this podcast and you're worried you don't know what you're supposed to be doing with your life, like, that's okay. You're going to be fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a great, you know, the Y Combinator investor Paul Graham, I excerpt a little bit of a graduation speech that he wrote but never gave in the book, where he basically calls this idea that you should have a long-term plan and know exactly what you're going to do. He says computer scientists call this premature optimization. Like all the successful people he knows take this approach of short-term planning, looking at the opportunities in front of them, taking them and being ready to adjust. And he was saying that just based on his experience with startups and people he knows, but that turns out to be like the seminal finding of this research discussed in Range called the Dark Horse Project. So these Harvard researchers who wanted to study how people find fulfilling careers. And their surprising finding was that those people are systematically averse to like rigid long-term planning. Their main common trait is short-term planning. So what they do is they say, here's who I am right now. Here are the skills I have. Here are the things I want to learn, the interests I want to explore. Here are the opportunities in front of me. Here's what I'll do. And maybe a year from now, I'll change because I will have learned something different and see a better fit. And they just do that and they zigzag their way to a place where they uniquely can succeed and feel fulfilled. And the reason this study was named the Dark Horse Project, that wasn't what it was called initially, was when they were studying these people who find fulfillment, all of those people would come in, you know, in their initial interviews and say like, well, I know you're trying to tell people how to go about finding a career, but like, don't give them the advice to do what I did, because I changed paths a whole bunch of times. And like, you know, wasn't one for long-term goal setting. And they found like 90% of the people say that. They're like, well, I'm not a good model. But in fact, that is the good model, but they think they're all oddballs or exceptions because it's hard advice to give, right? Like, when I was at Sports Illustrated, I would get contacted by students all the time asking, if I want to be a sports writer, should I major in English or journalism? And I studied geology and astronomy, so I have no idea. But I was still inclined to give them the advice that was like, you know, start doing your journalism internships right now, even though the source of power for me that allowed me to become the youngest senior writer there was the fact that I had this science background that was totally average when I was a science grad student, but totally exceptional when I was at a sports magazine. But it's hard advice to give, you know?
Okay, so we've been kind of dogging deliberate practice against dogging it, starting it too early. You don't want to start it too early. So the idea is like you're going to dabble for a couple years, you know, maybe into your early 20s. And then once you find something, that's when you start seeing these high performers starting the deliberate practice, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, deliberate practice is great, right? You want to do deliberate practice. I think, and Malcolm Gladwell and I were just invited back to the MIT Sloan Conference recently. And what he said, and again, this is on YouTube, he says, I've changed my mind. I think the fact that to be great requires a lot of practice. I thought that implied that you needed to focus narrowly and start early. And now I feel differently. And I think I thought what he was saying too, you know, and my ideas evolved since starting with my first book, but even more so now. And I think it's the implication that means that you should, to be great at X, you should only do X as early as possible is not supported by the research. So you still need to do a bunch of practice. But I think even after the dabbling, you should keep career streams open. So there's early in Range, I mentioned research on people who go from becoming great performers, essentially, whether that's like an athlete or a musician or a surgeon or whatever, to being people who are great at like running an orchestra or managing a sports team or running a hospital. And one of the features of those people, again, it's just another finding of the breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer, is the scientist studying this says they keep multiple career streams open. He says they're traveling an 8-lane highway instead of a 1-way street. And so even once they get more focused, they kind of keep other interests around a little bit. And eventually they're better able to transfer into these management positions. So I think even there, this breadth continues to be important. And so you shouldn't get totally blinkered even though at some point or another, all of us specialize to one degree or another, of course.
Well, you even highlight research that people who win Nobel Prizes because they've specialized in one particular area of science or mathematics, they are more likely to have like a hobby like improvisation or painting or music than just the average population.
Way more likely. They're 22 times more likely than other scientists to have a serious hobby that usually deals with like aesthetics, you know, music, magic, writing, art, glass blowing, all these sorts of things, generally tinkering. So they're much more like, so national level scientists who get inducted in national academies are much more likely to have serious hobbies than the average scientist. And the Nobel laureates are much more likely still. And so one of the phrases that I loved in Range was this researcher who studies scientific creativity calls a network of enterprise. They have a network of enterprise where they're doing all these different things that from afar might look like it's diluting their thinking. But in fact, a lot of this stuff ends up informing their ability to find problems that nobody else is looking at. So the father of modern neuroscience, the Spanish Nobel laureate, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, he has a quote that I loved. There's something like, from afar, it looks as if they are dissipating their energies, when in fact, they are channeling and strengthening them. And it's striking to read Nobel acceptance speeches in recent years, which I did a lot of, and see that almost every year, a scientist who's accepting an award says, something to the effect of, I wouldn't be able to do my research now because you have to be so narrow in looking for applications. So that strikes me as something that's worrisome.
No, we can talk about that in a minute. Like, I like this idea that these are individuals who have gone deep in one area, but they continue that breadth. I think there's like that guy from the design school, IDEO, he calls them like T-shaped people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so they got the vertical going up and down is the depth, and then they have like the horizontal part of the T, which is breadth.
Totally. And that comes up in Range in a section about inventors, where this woman who rose up to what's called corporate scientist at the company 3M, corporate scientist is like the highest title. She talks about how like people kept telling her not to change directions. And she's like basically never worked in anything she was educated for. But what she does is she knows how to sort of draw on her peers in order to assemble the I part of the T, essentially. She's very broad. She basically spends her time figuring out what everyone else is doing. She's obviously very science literate. She has a PhD, just doesn't work in her own area. And makes sure to know what everyone else around her is doing and uses them to help sort of cobble together the trunk of the T, but her contribution is more like the crossbar of the T. And she and other people like her have been able to use that kind of breadth with a grounding in a certain area and also drawing on other specialists to be really high impact. And I think that's why you see in some of the research I cite that the highest impact inventors are not the deepest specialists, but the inventors who do have an area of expertise where they have some depth, but then they spread their career over the largest number of different classes of technology as defined by the patent office, basically.
I want to talk about one more thing with in terms of fit, because I think it's very counterintuitive and it goes against what you hear growing up as a kid, and it's this idea that you should never quit anything, right? Once you start something, you got to see it through. You got to develop grit, which there's been a lot of talk about thanks to Duckworth and her research in her book. But this idea of finding fit, finding that, dabbling until you find the thing that you're good at and that that's made for you, that requires you're going to have to quit stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the sort of underlying messages of Range is when you find fit, it will look like grit. And I think we've made a mistake in the way we think about the study of personality, where we look at what people are now and assume that's who they are. But we change not only over time, but with context. So I think an emerging promising area of the study of personality studies what's called if-then signatures, where you might say, if David is at a massive party. He's an introvert, but if David is with his team, small team at work, then he's an extrovert. And it's turning out that personality is much more complicated and that we look different in different scenarios. And the same for grit or conscientiousness it's like the psychological construct of conscientiousness, where if you get fit, it'll look like you have grit. The same with the musicians, right? Where they weren't practiceaholics until they found an instrument that really fit their skills and their interests. And then they became practiceaholics. The famous studies of grit all involve subjects really short term. It's like people trying to get through 6 weeks of physical rigors at the U.S. Military Academy, or kids who are already in the final of the National Spelling Bee and trying to get farther. The studies are always done on a very select population of people who have a very narrow, well-defined, very short-term goal right in front of them. And the problem has been we've extrapolated that to all of life, where it doesn't make as much sense, where a lot of the research shows what you want to do is, you know, constantly be evaluating your opportunities. And Stephen Levitt, I quote him saying, one of his main talents, the Freakonomics economist, as people know him, one of his main talents has been to identify when he should abandon a project or a whole domain of study and move to another one. And so that motivated him to do a study of job quitting. And he found that when people are thinking about quitting, basically they should, because they move on to something that's a better fit. And Seth Godin, you know, that's given some of the most popular career advice ever, I think, says not only should you be willing to quit, not just because something's hard, right? You don't want to quit just because something's hard. But when you start something, you should basically always have in mind criteria under which you would decide to quit. And so I think while preaching grit is incredibly intuitively appealing, you know, I critique the science of grit at a lot more length in Range, but I think the way that we've extrapolated what it means does not comport with a huge body of research on how people find the areas where they can become the most productive and fulfilled.
Right. So you might not become world-class gritting yourself into something you're not a fit for, but once you find you're something that is a fit for you, the grit will could just come naturally, right? Because you'll just want to do it. And then you can become world-class because you're just sort of riding that wave of sort of internal motivation.
That's right. And you can think about, I mean, things that were sort of viewed by parents as the total opposite of grit, maybe not so long ago, like playing lots of video games, now are careers where they've drawn enough interest from people that may not have that sort of grit in other areas. Or, I mean, I was a college athlete, right? And there were, I think it's demonstrably false that grit is just a stable characteristic in people. So there were people who were, I was a track athlete, 800 meter runner, and there were guys I trained with who were absolute competitive demons, would claw your, you know, head off in a race, who had not a sign of competitiveness, not a competitive bone in their body when it came to the classroom, and vice versa. Right, so I think we all recognize these sorts of things, but we don't really have like good shared language for talking about them, or we don't think very deeply about them.
All right, so yeah, again, like if you're 20 something, don't feel bad if you're going to make a change in your major. Right. Or you decide you're going to quit law school because after the first semester, man, you realize I don't like law. Or even if you're 30 or 40 and you decide to quit your job, do something else, that's okay. It probably will turn out better for you.
Yeah. It's psychologically unsettling, right? It's riskier, as the Dark Horse Project researchers say, it's riskier to stick with that long-term goal before you really, you know, have sampled enough to formulate a good one than it is to abandon it. Like we always feel like we're in a rush, but I think you notice as you get a little older, like you weren't in as much of a rush as you think you are. And it's well worth it to put in a little bit of time investment in figuring out who you are and where you can make the biggest impact. So I do this going forward. I started what I call a book of experiments, where there are things like, and in 2018, one of my experiments was I spent some time volunteering and I wanted to figure out where could I make the biggest impact and where would I learn the most. So I spread my time over about a half dozen different organizations that year, found the two where I think I can actually contribute uniquely and also learn something. And now I focus in on those. And so I'm now, based on the research that went into the book, sort of constantly running experiments, setting up experiences in a way where I have a hypothesis, the experience can help me test that, reflecting on it, and then just keep zigzagging and triangulating my way to a place where I think I can uniquely succeed and feel good about what I'm doing.
Okay, so we've been talking about sort of this idea of range on an individual level. You want to, you know, dabble in lots of things so you can find fit, and that means you're going to have to quit things. Once you're learning something, you want the learning in the beginning to be hard, not easy, because if it's easy, it means you're probably not learning. But I want to go back to something you said about, you know, you read all these acceptance speeches from Nobel Prize winners. I want to talk about how this idea of specialization and sort of downplaying the importance of range is affecting us on a broader scale. And you highlight research or, you know, just ideas from Nobel Prize winners that our specialization that we've been doing, our hyper-specialization we've been doing in science and in other areas, it's actually preventing breakthroughs from coming through, and they're actually diminishing over time.
Yeah, so you can see that even as funding has gone up, breakthroughs have not, basically, have gone backward. And you can also see this in outcomes we sort of care more about even than breakthroughs, right? Like, we're the most medically advanced country in the world and life expectancy is going backward. Same thing in the UK. And what these scientists highlight is, and some of them study the science of science, right? Like, how can we have good science get done? And what they find is basically that you don't want to force people to be too narrow. You basically, we've created a system where we're so focused on applications that we require people to narrow their research such that they can quickly come up with applications. And that's when they're applying for grants. And that is pretty much exactly contradictory to the history of science and where impactful discoveries come from. They typically come from someone who has some question they're curious about. There may not be any real clear application, and just investigating that question leads to these huge breakthroughs. Because the biggest breakthroughs tend to come where you don't really know what the right question is, right? And so you have to allow people to explore pretty broadly. And the problem we have now, as one of the characters in the last chapter, is this guy who's, you know, arguably the most influential immunologist in the world. And he's starting a program that's meant to despecialize the education of future scientists, because he says what we have now is what he calls a system of parallel trenches, where everyone is in their own little trench and they're not usually standing up and looking at what's going on in the next trench, even though that's where their answer is. And so what he's seen in immunology is everyone studying one tiny part of a complex system in such isolation that we've failed to understand how these systems work and connect ideas. And you can write a grant that is for the study of some system of the body, and you can't even get it funded because the people reviewing it only know about one little aspect and say, well, you know, we don't really know about the rest of that. So what we really, the world is divided up into disciplines, not because that's the way we divide the world into disciplines, not because that's the way the world really is. It's a necessary evil for just categorizing the studies we do. So we're in the place of putting the world back together after we study things in individual disciplines. And so I think what he and other scientists who are paying attention to this want to do is make interdisciplinary research and interdisciplinary thinking systematic, because the world is interdisciplinary, and we're going in the wrong direction on that as we force people to be more and more narrow so they see a smaller and smaller part of complex systems.
But I mean, do you think there's hope? Like, is that sort of a growing idea or a growing movement within science that we need to get interdisciplinary if we want to make breakthroughs, or are people really entrenched in their little silo?
I mean, I think there are people like that scientist, his name is Arturo Casadevall, who are so prominent in their area that they are bringing some attention to it. But I still think it's going against the grain. Like, I went to a panel that he was on about, there's this thing going on in science right now called the replication crisis, and it has to do with a huge number of scientific findings turn out like not to be true, basically. And part of the reason for that, Arturo argues, is because of this certain type of specialization where people are doing science before they've really been taught the broader concepts of how scientific thinking should even work. So they essentially don't know what they're doing and end up with bad results. And by the way, in the book, I confess to the fact that when I was a science grad student, I did the same thing, but I didn't realize it until much later when I was a journalist writing about bad science, which is kind of disappointing. And so Arturo's on this panel talking about how we need to despecialize science education. And the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, probably the most prominent medical journal in the world, says, no, you can't do that. Like, it already takes way too much time to in education for students to become MDs or PhDs. Like, we can't add time with this broader conceptual stuff and having them do things that aren't exactly where they're going to work. And Arturo's response was, yeah, get rid of all that didactic stuff that we teach them that goes in one ear and out the other ear in 2 weeks anyway, and that they can find on their phone. What we've got, he said, is a bunch of people walking around with all the world's knowledge on their phone and no ability to integrate it. So his feeling was, you can get rid of that stuff. Like, our tools, our information finding tools, have allowed us not to worry as much about teaching that didactic stuff because we can find it. Meanwhile, we've skipped over teaching people the broader concepts of how to even do science. And it's helped land us in this replication crisis where it's turning out that most scientific findings are probably not true because, you know, I was a grad student at Columbia University, which is obviously like a reputable institution, and skipped straight to learning the particulars of Arctic plant physiology before I learned how science and statistics actually work for me to draw true conclusions. And so I have published research out there now that I'm quite sure would fall to the replication crisis if someone tried to replicate it.
Well, it's probably an example of learning a procedure, right? Sort of shallowly, superficially. You do it and then you get it looks like science, but not really.
Yeah. And the thing is, now with computers, anyone can get a huge data set and run statistical programs on it, and you'll come up with some positive results. And the fact is, like myself, most of the scientists out there don't really understand what they're doing when they're running those statistical tests because we've never even been taught to think about it, basically. So again, only as a journalist was I made to sort of reflect on what I'd been doing in the past. And so that's what I think Arturo wants to do, is he wants to teach thinking. And that's what James Flynn of the Flynn Effect suggests in the second chapter, is we have to teach these varieties of thinking. Otherwise, none of this didactic information and procedures really makes sense anywhere except for these incredibly narrow applications.
Well, David, there's a lot more that we could talk about because there's so much more in this book. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
DavidEpstein.com. There's a description of the book and some early reviews up there. And I think it's and some other work, and it should be hopefully available in your favorite bookseller.
David Epstein, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's mine.
My guest today is David Epstein. He's the author of the book Range. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, check out my previous interview with David. It's episode number 127. It's about his book, The Sports Gene. Check out our show notes, aom.is/range, where you can find links to resources. We can delve deeper in this topic. Also, check out David's website, davidepstein.com, where you can find more information about his work. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website, artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, over 500 there, as well as thousands of articles written over the year about personal finance, health and fitness, style, how to be a better husband, better father, you name it, we've got it. And if you'd like to check out ad-free episodes of The Art of Manliness, you can do so only on Stitcher Premium. And so you can get a free month of Stitcher Premium when you sign up at stitcherpremium.com and use promo code manliness. After you sign up at stitcherpremium.com, you download the app on iOS and Android, and you can start enjoying new episodes of The Art of Manliness ad-free. Again, use that promo code manliness to get a free month of Stitcher Premium. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.